We're the Pragmatic Doulas.
This is a podcast where we talk all about birth and other interesting things.
Birth may be a goddess, but she doesn't want to be worshipped. She wants to be respected. She doesn't want incense. She wants
common sense.
Okay, there we go. You're on.
We are on. Welcome.
Hello, everybody.
I'm Stephanie, and I'm in my closet.
Can you get a little bit closer to your mic?
I can get a little bit closer to my mic. How is that?
A little bit better. You just sound kind of far away.
Yeah.
I'm in my closet.
I mean, I don't know how much closer you can. I mean, isn't that supposed to be good studio conditions? I keep meaning to try doing this in my basement closet.
That's the room.
It's insulated.
Weird.
Yeah. Well, anyway. I'm Suzanne. While Stephanie tries to figure out her positioning. Yeah. And I'm feeling sleepy today. Even though it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
True.
Yeah.
But on a Friday, no less. But it's a long weekend, so yay!
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Thanksgiving weekend, which means we will all be gathering with our families or around a big table full of food and hoping not to get into fights over politics. So there you go.
It's just my immediate family. We won't have that drama.
Well, that is good to hear. But I will jump right into our land acknowledgement so that we can move on to our amazing topic today.
Cool.
So I'm doing it today. I acknowledge that here, and I reside in the city of Pickering, which is on the land within the jurisdiction of the Williams Treaties and on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the Scugog Island First Nations, the Anishinaabe, the Chippewa, the Haudenosaunee, and Wendat peoples. This acknowledgement reminds me of my responsibility to the relationships and to these ancestral lands on which I live and I'm learning and sharing here on this podcast. And in thinking about acknowledgement today, I was really drawn to think about that I am quite literally living where someone else lived today, where someone else lived with their children, where someone else was removed from their land for the betterment of some settler, some colonizer, and how absolutely horrifying and humbling it is to know that I'm sitting here very comfortably in my space. And it really drove home for me today the importance of acknowledging it, the importance of making sure that I'm voting appropriately so that things are changing, so that things are bettering, so that things are being acknowledged, and that it needs to not just be a good life for me here where I'm living, it needs to be a good life for wherever you are, wherever you're situated, and that absolutely everybody is entitled to have a safe space to raise your family in Canada, and in particular for those who were misplaced from their lands because of my colonizer ancestors. So those are my thoughts on land acknowledgement and acknowledging my responsibilities as a person currently living here.
Those are some big thoughts.
Those were some very big thoughts.
It was big feelings today, big feelings as I sat here literally looking out my window and thinking that I'm living very close to water in particular. And so many of the treaty lands that people were removed from, that the Indigenous families were removed from, were close to water sources, right?
Yeah.
Clean water sources, fishing resources, ability to take care of their families is almost always found close to safe water sources. And that's where I live. I live down on the water. And so it was that bit more horrifying for me today to sit and think about that. And it really lifting me back up into actively looking at who is making change these days, who is fighting against change, and my responsibilities around that.
And I guess it's especially poignant this weekend as we all cozy down
to have those Thanksgiving gatherings, as you were saying. And I will be going to my sister. We will be within the limit of gatherings indoors. There'll be less than 20 of us, which will seem outrageously small. The kids will complain, but my sister and I have decided that we're for sure going to do a land acknowledgement at our gathering tomorrow, and maybe have a discussion about it. It will be easier to have a discussion with a smaller group of people who are gathering together, instead of the usual 50 or 60 of us that are usually together. So,
Jesus.
Yeah. That's, yeah, I know. People.
Jesus.
It's outrageous. Christmas, we're hoping Christmas things will have settled and we can do a big Christmas gathering, but for this particular time, we're only going to be doing just a few of us. So, yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it'll be my three children and my mother. That's it. That's my whole family. It was funny when the social worker called today to talk about my uncle and sort of his living arrangements. She's like, and do you have any other family, you know, that are able to help out and whatnot? I'm like, no, family are shit. They're awful and they're not around. So no, it's me. Literally me. Uh-huh. She's like, okay, well, we can definitely get you the resource. I'm like, bitch, you better find
please do.
You better that's find me here. Some resources, because I'm about to go crazy here.
Yeah. This really does make a big difference, because I am kind of acting as second tier support, I guess you can say. I have a cousin in Nova Scotia who's caring for her mom, who's pretty ill right now and elderly and has dementia and all of that. And her husband moved to Nova Scotia years and years ago, away from us, my very big extended family here. And so she's kind of managing. As a matter of fact, a text of hers just came in. She asked me if I had any more questions that I think that she should ask the doctor. And yeah, we have an opposite experience, where even though she's by herself, she's not by herself. I was conference calling in with her, with the doctor. So I'm supporting her because she's supporting her mom. And as you know, that shit is hard as hell. It is hard to raise babies and children by yourself. And it is hard to take care of your elderlies by yourself.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think, like, growing in the past 8 years since my marriage ended, I've actually been really, really good being single. Like, I love this existence. I love not having to, you know, bounce anything off another adult. I just fucking do my own shit. Like, I don't have to get buy-in from anybody else. I just make the dinner that I want. I buy the groceries that I want. I spend the money on what I want. I do what I want. Uh-huh. However, this past week has been like, I literally just need somebody there to put their arm around me and just go, I'm here. I got your back. I'll take care of this. I'll take care of that. I'll do this. You take care of that. You've got support. And it's like, oh God, how great would that be? Now, having said that, desperately not willing to give up my freedom of being single for that. So that's fine. I'm going to have to get over my damn self, but it is difficult. It is difficult. Like, I would love somebody to come and do my yard work for the fall, because fuck, I don't want to do that. But I know that my kids will help. I mean, Thomas is working like every hour on the weekends and whatnot, but I know Will will help out. He's been a great support, and Allie too. So, you know, they help out where they can.
Support people need support.
100%.
It goes back and back and back.
What is that? That they call it secondary trauma, or what is it? Is that, what do they call it when doulas get like,
Yeah,
secondary trauma.
Yeah, it's like you're you're going through exactly the same thing almost that they're going through, obviously not the physical stuff, but there's a lot of stuff sort of dumped on you as a, as an individual, when you're a support person and when you're dealing with the resources of, you know, a government, it's like, oh, God.
Yeah.
The red tape and paperwork.
It's a lot of strength, a lot of mental energy, emotional and physical energy to mm-hmm. provide the kind of support that we provide for new families, and then to provide that same emotional, physical, and mental support to an older person. It's how much of that energy does can any one person have? And when you have your own support, it gives you that boost. It does give you that boost. So if you knew that somebody was at home, making sure the kids were okay and taking care of all of that, and the yard work was being done, it gives you just that boost to go out in the middle of the night to do whatever it is you need to do.
Exactly.
Because you know you're leaving hearth and home in good hands. But when you know you're leaving hearth and home on hold until you get back and all that is still waiting for you, fuck, it's exhausting.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't want to take away like from my children either. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to give so much to one person. Not that I'm not going to, because I am, but it's mm-hmm. difficult to know that I'm giving so much to one person and then maybe, you know, still trying to give as much to them who are my children. Like they are, I will walk
your
through
primary
for that
primary responsibility. Yeah.
100%. They are my primary responsibility. But it's like it almost feels easier to take away from them while I'm dealing with this immediate thing. And that's not fair to them. You know what I mean?
We're fortunate that our children are older now.
Yeah.
This, what you're going through right now couldn't happen if you had nursing babies and toddlers and preschoolers at home.
Oh, no, I would have been like, nope, somebody has to.
Somebody else has to do it because number one, not only are your children your primary responsibility, but when their needs are so demanding, their physical needs on a day-to-day basis, you won't be able to stretch it.
No.
It's only possible now because your children are older.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can leave them at home alone. Like that's the only reason why it's possible.
Yeah. And it's funny when I said to my mom, because I'm getting a little dark as this whole thing is going on. I get a little dark in that, you know, like, okay, well, when it comes to the funeral, like it's already like paid for and all of that stuff. But I can tell you right now, I'm not inviting any of the relatives that are here. Mom was like, oh, but I do not gotta do anything. If they were so important to his life, they would be in it right now.
Here. While he's alive,
they're not calling, they're not coming over to help, they're not doing a goddamn fucking thing. So that funeral will include the neighbors who have been an incredible support, you, my mother. Mm-hmm. And my mom goes, well, what about Alan? And I go, what, Alan, who called him the one time after you told him to call? You're gonna have to let me think about Alan. That one.
Fuck Alan.
Fuck that. Fuck all of that. I'm sorry. I'm not spending money and booze on people who are just there to be giant fucking freeloaders. Piss mm-hmm. off. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. It's going to be a very small funeral. And I'm going to spend the money. I've decided that I'm going to spend the money in a memorial for, you know, their resting place. They didn't do that part. So that's to honor them, my uncle and my aunt, that's what I'm going to do with the money. I'm not going to spend it on that bloody lot of Scottish fucking freeloaders.
Oh my God.
Anyways, that's how that's going to go down.
Yes.
And I'm sure it won't go down well. And I don't care.
And this is the other side of doula life.
It is. It's the sandwich generation. Quite literally, you know,
I am the bologna
you know
in a
what?
Sandwich.
This conversation, again, as so many of our conversations do, dates us. This is the kind of thing, this is the kind of issue that our age group is dealing with. We have children who are young adults
and elderly parents and relatives who need care. And we're being pulled in both of those directions. That is unique to people who are squarely late 40s, early 50s.
And running your own businesses. So actually having to pay your own bills, because parenting kids and parenting older folks does not pay those bills. But it takes
no
large amount of the emotional energy that otherwise people, you know, use to sustain themselves and to pay their bills, to do the things that pay their bills. Oh, Suzanne, are you being a nosy neighbor?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I moved my chair away from the window and I think I'm going to regret it, because I'm going to have to keep doing that. Because if I hear something, I cannot help but look outside. But now I can't just look outside. I have to get up and go see what's going on. And when I can't tell what's going on outside, I get very annoyed. Oh my God.
And you just dated yourself yet again.
Yeah, just dated myself yet again. I'm Gladys Kravitz. I was raised in a teeny tiny community where everybody knew everybody and everybody knew everybody's business. And it's just, it's in my DNA. Okay. I can't help it.
It's in the Scottish DNA too.
Harry, yeah, I cannot help it.
Harry's bed is like bed number one and the door is just there. So he's like, and he can't see, like his eyesight is so poorly, but he's like, oh, who's that? Who's going by? Is that the doctor? Is that the nurse? Honey, you need to just watch the TV. Okay. Like, don't worry about what's happening on the outside of the door.
It would be good if they just had glass doors. You could just watch all the comings and goings and maybe read lips. Then he'd be able to tell all the business in the hospital.
Yep. Yep. All right. What is our topic?
Our topic today is the birth experience in Brazil.
Birthing in Brazil?
Yes. And I was going to say, and other Latin countries, but really it's Brazil that we nailed down here. I mean, it's no surprise to anybody, I'm sure, in the birth world who might be listening to this. We can't help but keep our fingers on the pulse of what birthing experience looks in other parts of the world. But Brazil has a countrywide 55.5% cesarean rate. In private hospitals, it is 84%, 84.6%.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Can we just take a moment for those numbers?
And what's up with that? Is that what we're going to be talking about? What's up with that?
That's what we'll call this. Brazil. What's up with that?
Yes. Yes.
And the first time you guys heard those numbers, what did you think?
So the reason this kind of topic came up is I had a recent client that from Brazil, but I've had other clients that are from Brazil. And one I had was many years ago. And she was telling me that, you know, the cesarean birth rate in Brazil was like 80%. And I'm like, wait, what? Like, I hadn't been a doula that long. And I was like, what are you talking? What do you mean? That's so much. So I promptly started like looking it up. I'm like, Jesus, she's right. Like, how is this possible? So when I first heard these sort of rates, I was flabbergasted. It was crazy.
Mm-hmm. And I've had... I can remember one in particular, and this was a very wealthy, like super wealthy people. They didn't work, kind of wealthy. Oh. They just had money. I think the...
What's that like?
I'll tell you what it's like. it looks delicious. His family, I think, had money somehow. And so they just like lived there. They just did whatever they wanted. And even though they lived here in Toronto, went to the States because she elected to have a C-section despite having absolutely no medical
necessity for that or anything. So I was her their overnight doula for quite a while. And this was pretty early on in my doula career. And I remember being floored that somebody would just fly to another country to give birth by cesarean section, just because that's what she wanted. And now, mind you, I support that. Mm-hmm. Like that's her business. Mm-hmm. Not my business. That's her business. However, at that time, I was floored because I had never heard of that kind of thing before. I said, so you actually went? Oh yes, it was a private clinic. I said, a private clinic? Yeah, it wasn't even a hospital. It was some kind of maternity clinic somewhere. I don't know where the heck it was. And it was beautiful. And it was like a spa. And she had a C-section. And she stayed there for a week. And then they flew back home. And that was that. My jaw was just like, what? Is this how rich people, like, this is what rich people do? The rest of us are over here pushing babies out of our wahoos. And you go to a spa and have a baby lifted out of your body. Okay, that was my thinking at the time. So that was my one exposure to Brazilian birth culture transplanted to the US and cushioned up with lots and lots of money. Now, that is my question. When I hear those numbers, immediately I always think, how many of those people are people of color? How many of those people are rich people? What kind of healthcare system is there in Brazil? That's what I want to know.
So the research that I did. So yeah, in private clinics, the rate is like in the 80s for cesarean. And I read an article from the Washington Post that was published in June 2019 that indicated that there were basically birth party planners where you would get like this. I mean. Yeah. Private hospitals, they had viewing galleries built for the party. The birthing parent would get their hair and makeup done beforehand. And in Sao Paulo, they were building a 22-story maternity ward, which was at that time was currently under construction, which was going to include a ballroom and a wine cellar.
What?
Yeah. I was like, okay, wait, what?
Yeah. That all sounds nutso. And it all sounds, again, cushioned by money.
Oh, 100%.
These are not people living in the inner streets of Rio.
No, and I have more information on that too, actually. But Steph, did you have stuff? Don't want to take over.
I was reading through the same things about. So it started one way, right? So we start from where it started is in the 1970s, much like here, the cesarean rate was 15%.
Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. However, what drove them from the late 70s, 1979 at 15% to 1984 at 40%, right? That is the short window from which they went from the World Health Organization's basis for this is the top end of safe cesareans for the worldwide community to 40% of cesareans being done countrywide in 1984. So birthing back in the 70s, first of all, they were birthing so much more often in the 70s. There were babies flying out everywhere in Brazil. It is now one third. They are now having one third the amount of babies in the 2000s than they were in the 1970s and 80s. So the amount of babies being born has significantly dropped. There's lots of babies being born back then. And the conditions in which, even in hospital, I'm talking here, were abysmal. These were not properly funded, properly set up, like safe birthing spaces the way we think about them. They were understaffed, they were undernursed, labs. There wasn't a lot of their infrastructure. Their funding was not given to maternity care. It was not given to birthing care. So birthing back in the 70s could be a very scary event. You were and almost everybody, again, it's very similar to Canada and the US, almost everyone in the 70s, when it was time to have your baby, you were on your back, you were cut open. They were not even necessarily, there was a lot of complaints of it not being sterile environments when these things were happening. It was rushed because there were so many babies and so few staff. Like hospitals were busting at the seams with having children. So when they started putting some funding into birthing centers, one of the first things they put in was more cesarean theaters, safe cesarean theaters. And along with that messaging, and you guys will tell me if you think this messaging sounds familiar to anything else, all of a sudden there were these quote unquote clean, sterile, scheduled one-on-one care from the time you arrive at the hospital to the time you have your baby in the theater to the postpartum care was you were never left alone. You were in a sterile area. You were in a clean area. You were taken care of. And afterwards you were directly taken to a postpartum unit where you were taken care of. So the cesarean experience became the exact opposite of what they were calling natural, but what I'll just call the vaginal experience, the vaginal birth experience of someone going into spontaneous labor. So these things were, as soon as I read this and the messaging around it and the way it was offered, it reminded me of when formula came in and the messaging in certain places about how formula was better, safer. You could measure it. You could give it to your baby and know how much they're having. And, you know, pictures of, you know, big, fat, happy faced babies, healthy, sparkling eyes on the fronts of these formula cans. And it as soon as I was reading all of these things, I thought it wasn't the safety of it. It wasn't any of that. It was the message of better that really. And this was also at a time when more people were being offered health insurance. People were buying into health insurance at the time. So you were able to have it covered. So that's what took us from people at a 15% to 40% in the 80s. And then from that time, when it became scheduled and easy and the message was accepted that this was safer and easier, it only grew from there. And then, of course, as we do in communities, we share that with others who are birthing. This was so good because, this was so wonderful because, and we've gone just from it being great, scheduled, I don't have to worry about who's going to be there or having a horrible birth experience, to it being scheduled and happy, or scheduled and safe, to now scheduled, hair, makeup, party. It costs an average to plan one of these parties $10,000 before you rent the viewing room. Before you rent the viewing room at your cesarean. So I don't know if you grabbed this, Suzanne, when Kim was mentioning it. It's literally a room with an opaque window, and there's a lounge room, there's a bathroom, there's a private kitchen, and it's usually a catered event. You can change the coloring in the room to suit your theme. The decor, and generally people go home with plants or something like a party favor afterwards. And what happens is you're brought into the operating room and you're having your cesarean and you're prepared for this. And then when the baby, after they've gone through the 7 layers of your body to get to your baby, as the baby is being lifted out of your body, the window goes completely transparent. You can see right through it and you can watch the baby being brought into the world to take their first breath. And so the family gets to watch that last bit while having their wine and their champagne and their cheese boards and things like that. So it's become a family event, but through cesarean as opposed to a family event at your home.
So this is that new facility that's being built?
Oh no, it's already built. These are since the late 80s, almost every private hospital had one vaginal labor and delivery room, and all the rest are birthing operating theaters. Like they didn't have the facilities for, or the staff for that. They had staff for cesarean births. So that's what they are already at. But this new 22 floor facility is all about, making sure that those things are met. So they are making half of it cesarean and half of it birthing suites. So people who are birthing spontaneously.
Yeah. I wonder what it's like in the public hospitals, which I assume make up the majority of the births. Brazil has a very high population. It's a very populated country. It's also not a rich country. It's also a colonized country and extremely diverse with a history of slavery and colonization. And whenever we're speaking about a country with that kind of history, I really think hard about how that has impacted how the people of that country do things today. So my thoughts are that one of the things that I know also has become a feature in Brazilian culture, and I wish we had a Brazilian person here too, because I feel creepy speaking about a culture that I'm not a part of, is cosmetic surgery. Yes. Like rhinoplasty and, you know, the famous Brazilian butt lift and other kinds of cosmetic surgery have become normalized in that culture. And I am trying to think to myself how this fits in, how this normalizing of cesarean section as a method of birth fits in to other surgeries being normal. Like at 16, you get a nose job and it's totally normal that you get whatever you want to get to make yourself as beautiful as possible. There's a beauty ideal or something that I've from afar I've heard about or glimpsed at. And I 100% want to acknowledge that I might be talking about a segment of the population. I don't want to make it sound as if this is everybody, the regular, ordinary Brazilian. However, that's the image that we get from this vantage point, that there's this striving for this beauty ideal. And I'm wondering if that whole, a European beauty ideal, and I'm wondering if that whole thing has played into this desire for a cesarean because of this assumption that, you know, you keep everything intact. Your vulva, your labia, your vagina is still virginal. You take your baby out of your belly.
I will say, so what I had been reading and the articles that I read did not necessarily indicate that. What was indicated out of all the articles was that it was believed that cesarean birth was safer. So that safer than vaginal birth. So some of the information that I got was, so when the rates got to be like 80-90%, it became apparent that, you know, this kind of goes against what the World Health Organization is suggesting is a safe birth practices. So in an effort to sort of lower those rates, some hospitals like Albert Einstein Hospital had opened up 5 new what they quoted natural birth centers. And they had like private showers and tubs and, you know, actively promoted vaginal birth. In São Luís, you could choose like lighting and whatnot for the room and have your MP3. So kind of like our, you know, the alongside midwifery clinic, it had like, you know, kind of all the bells and whistles. And then them in doing that lowered or increase the vaginal birth rate from 18% in those areas to 50%. So they were trying to make some changes. However, this national effort to make those changes to lower the cesarean rate ended up having a negative impact on Black Brazilian women and those in lower income areas. The article that I read from Anthropology News indicated that current programs of reducing unnecessary interventions was interpreted by the working class Afro-Brazilian women and families in Salvador as a sign of the state's disregard for their lives. This article also indicated that medical interventions in birth are unevenly distributed and that Black Brazilian women have less access to prenatal and birth care and die of obstetric causes up to 7 times the rate of white women. They are also less likely to get pain relief or even have a family member with them to accompany them, and are less likely to have an elective cesarean birth. Non-medical pain management was seen by one woman in this article as a way of prolonging her daughter's suffering. So I think it's kind of the way everything I read was not necessarily about a beauty ideal of your vagina, but more of a, you know, what they felt, and obviously I'm not speaking to them, but what I interpreted as a vaginal birth being dangerous and cesarean birth being cleaner, safer, a better way to go.
Yes. I know. I didn't mean to suggest that it was as trivial, trite as that, but that it was a part of a larger culture of beauty standards that has to do with that, because that is a part of it too. People worry about their bodies and what their bodies are going to look like after they have babies. That's a real thing. I'm curious about what the infant mortality rate is in Brazil.
Well, yeah, that I never
saw. Does anybody know that? Anybody know that?
I don't know what the rate was, but in 2015, the concern around the infant mortality rate, but mostly it was the infant NICU rate. The NICU rate was slowly, or not so slowly actually, going up and up and up. And it wasn't the maternal morbidity rate that was concerning them so much, although that was up as well. It was that there was a bit of a halt pulled when the NICU rates were climbing and climbing and climbing. And what was happening is around 2015, for convenience, babies were being born by cesarean section earlier and earlier and earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So it was at that point that, and I wish I had written down her name, she basically hauled everybody in, government officials, doctors, doulas, midwives, activists, and they formed the Appropriate Birth Project. And in doing so, and again, this, unfortunately, all the things that came from this gathering of information and professionals was only put to work in the private hospitals, the Einstein hospitals, mm-hmm. And 35 other hospitals, all private, in order to bring down the cesarean rate, bring up the safe vaginal rate, and start changing the messaging around it being safer to have a cesarean. But they also knew, and Kim brought this up, they knew their audience. So they started having party planners who were on call. You would plan ahead of time for when you go into labor, and then those party planners would come in on call to help you get your makeup and your hair and all those things done.
And it could all be arranged within 8 hours.
Yes. And all of, so they took what they knew culturally to be important, as well as having all of your family members there, a viewing room for when your baby is being born. Same thing, but for this. Now, unfortunately, that messaging, when we move over to the public hospitals, it created that sense of stress. So where the messaging was so strong that cesarean was safer and vaginal was not safe, now the belief system and some of the rebellion came that you're taking away cesareans now, and you're going to try and put this here in the public hospitals where we're already, quote, only at 50%. And you're going to try and force us to have vaginal births, which are not as safe. So they're already being ignored in so many ways and already feeling like their safety is not being taken care of with only a 50% rate. There was actually concern at the public hospitals that they were going to try and implement the same things because the belief system was so clear that cesarean is what you wanted. However, in the public hospitals, the morbidity rates were higher, the infection rates were higher, all around cesarean rates. So the actual health outcomes were poorer in the health, in whether it was vaginal or cesarean, in those public hospitals. So the
message, which could, would serve to reinforce the notion that vaginal birth is unsafer, because in the places where there are more vaginal births, they have higher infection rates and so on.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Because it's poor care. And a lot of the people who did come in for birthing there did not necessarily have access to prenatal care.
Mm-hmm.
So, which we already know in generally in communities where someone does not have access to prenatal care and you arrive in birth, in labor, that you were going to have poorer outcomes because you weren't cared for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things that we might have been able to help preemptively were not cared for simply because of not having access to the funds.
I mean, who's pushing this narrative? Who's benefiting from this narrative? Because we know, and so many of us in most parts of the world, including the World Health Organization, know that cesarean birth absolutely is safer in certain situations where in the mother and baby's safety is at risk. And so surgical intervention is necessary. But outside of that vaginal birth is eminently safer.
Mm-hmm.
And
who's driving it is a great question. And one of the biggest things that came up is that even those who were standing and wanting a vaginal birth, some had to sign waivers, both in the public hospital and in the private hospitals, to their insurance companies when their insurance companies would initially refuse to let them have a vaginal birth. You would have to then sign a waiver acknowledging the risks. This is insurance companies acknowledging the risks of having a vaginal birth instead of a cesarean birth.
This is baffling, because it's as if the entire country, the insurance companies, obviously obstetricians, healthcare, the entire healthcare system is based and operating on the premise that cesarean birth is safer. And so therefore it makes sense that everybody, rich families, poor families, that everybody is seeking that, because of who doesn't want to have a safer birth? And so the question is, where did that narrative come from? Where did that idea come from? Who's benefiting from it and how? Because everybody else is saying something different.
Well, I mean, if we look back, if we take it all the way back again, if we talk about colonizer approaches and capitalist approaches, it's those who stand to benefit. Physicians encourage one-on-one relationships. A large part of their culture is also having your doctor at your birth, and that there's some sort of less safe message if you have a doctor who's not your doctor because they don't know you. So it's literally considered less safe to not have your doctor. So a large part of their culture is having your own doctor. And how do you guarantee you have your own doctor? By planning a cesarean section. This message, and there's a woman who is being interviewed who is part of the Appropriate Birth Project. And without being completely clear or saying it directly, she was saying that doctors are part of the problem because they encourage that narrative. They encourage the narrative that it is safer. They encourage the narrative that it is important for you to have your doctor, understanding that that's important to their, they say that it's a point important to their clientele, so it becomes important to them. But honestly, you as the physician are responsible for the education. And if it doesn't benefit you to educate them, are you going to educate them?
And that seemed to be an overwhelming sort of theme that I read in the studies and articles that I read, was that, you know, that they found that they were able to lower the rates in some areas simply by just having conversations and having, you know, buy-in from the medical staff to educate and have a more personal experience with them, with those that were with everybody. So it was like what I'm reading, I'm like, oh, childbirth education, you know, that's kind of what it's, you know, part of what it was about.
So like any cultural norm, it is driven by the culture and the things that you come to value. So it's, if you are told something is of value or safe or safer, that's the first step, and it builds from there. So, the change would have to come from the top down here, though, and then have a positive vaginal birth experience and having a birth where you feel heard and listened to, and it felt warm and welcoming, and your family was allowed to attend, even if it's in a viewing room, and you're allowed to do all those things that have become the cultural norms. So I'm thankful that in the private spaces, they've created that Now, the thing is they're going to have to move that to the public sector. They're going to have to, in order to really create change, they're going to have to revamp their infrastructure in getting that prenatal education to the masses, to those who cannot afford it, to those who do not have insurance.
Yes, but the issue
is still too high.
But the issue does, it seems like that there's no incentive to change. There's no feeling or urge to change. If this is like you know, the way that a lot of the hospitals here are trying to change their cesarean section rate, because the underlying belief is that cesarean section is not safer and puts a greater burden on our healthcare system. So it makes sense that we should be trying to reduce the amount of C-sections that we're doing. But if that foundational belief is not there, then who now is going to drive the change? It's only going to be people like the organization Appropriate Birth. It's going to be small pockets. It's going to, like it always is, small pockets of women, small pockets of birthing people saying, this is what I want. I don't want to change the whole world, but let's change it just for us, you know, like whole birth organizations and so on, until some big groundswell comes, the way that we had midwifery regulation happen. And so now so many more people have access to midwives and the choices that that brings. But that didn't happen overnight. No. And that didn't happen because somebody said, hey, you know what? Here's a good idea. It happened slowly and with thousands and thousands of hours of blood, sweat, and tears from the people who believe in this alternative, like in Brazil, having like a home water birth would be a strictly alternative thing, or even just a vaginal birth is an alternative thing. It would take that kind of plotting effort to affect that kind of change, it seems, because if the nation as a whole, the culture, the birthing culture as a whole, feels that vaginal birth is more dangerous, who's gonna go marching for it?
And I mean, that's decades and decades and decades of, you know, PR propaganda against vaginal birth, right? How can you undo that kind of, you know, ingrained thought on the process? I mean, you hear it here every now and then, you know, you'll hear someone in your class, usually the dad, will say, you know, well, why wouldn't you just have a cesarean? Vaginal birth seems so, you know, scary and dangerous. And it's like, I get what you're saying. And yeah, it does seem that way. However, statistically, we know X, Y, Z. But you know, I mean, I know there's been dads that have left my class going, yep, still think a cesarean's better, you know, despite everything that I've talked about. And granted, you know, if the birthing parent was like, yeah, I want a cesarean, I'm like, you know what, girl, I support you.
Yeah.
As long as you're making that decision, knowing the benefits, risks, and alternatives, we will support whatever you want to do, period.
But the change that will come in Brazil, and there is, so this has really only started to be talked about in public and out loud because it's so discouraging. I mean, you have insurance companies, you have your aunties, you have your grandmas all telling you at this point to have a cesarean, that it is those one-offs, the very rare ones who did have home births back in the day, who still have that knowledge, and there's very few who plant the seeds in the younger generation. And what the younger generation is experiencing right now, because there is no private care for home birth down there, you can get payment from your insurance to have to pay a midwife, but it's not like it's not easy. And you have to sign waivers, and there's a lot of things hoops you have to jump through to do that. So often when people are planning a home birth right now, it is against their family's wishes. It is against their doctor's wishes. It is against their community's wishes to go backwards. So there, whereas here we've seen and talked about it more often, they are still really just starting to come back to that as an option and planting that seed. There is a, there, it is there. It is happening. They, in the interviews that I was watching, there are small pockets of women who are helping birthing people prepare for birth that is vaginal, whether it's in hospital or home, and planting the seeds of home being an option as well. But it, I feel like that, much like it did here, once we hit hospital, it was the swing back was hard to make. Mm-hmm. But it is happening. I was really happy to hear the interviews with some people. I was very unhappy, but not surprised to hear that you did have to fight your insurance company, that you did have to fight your family, that you did have to fight a lot of people and really undo the parts of yourself as well that were, there was a one young woman who's pregnant and she had to fight her family. And in doing so, realize that in choosing to have a home birth so that she had a lower chance of cesarean, she was having to give up having her mom and her aunties with her and her family there because they were so scared, so indoctrinated in cesarean being safer that they wouldn't attend.
But that's sad.
That's exactly what I mean, that the change sounds like it's starting, like you said, planting the seeds are being planted right now, but it's starting from the bottom up. That's not happening from the top down.
Oh, you know what? It's never going to. No. I mean, I've said this from time immemorial, that even in Canada, in Toronto, any changes that are going to happen when it comes to birth and where we birth and how we birth and all of that stuff, it's not going to come from the top down. It is going to come from the consumers, because even though we have, you know, universal healthcare, even though, you know, we have OHIP and whatnot, it's still consumer driven. And we are going, it's not us that's going to make the change. It's the birthing parents that are going to make the change in demanding better for themselves and demanding what they want for their own birth.
Yeah. All social justice movements or any movement, any change has always happened by the people that are directly affected. It always starts there.
Yeah.
That's why they're called grassroots, because that's where it starts. So yeah. Those people in those organizations, those people who want to birth at home, who are willing to sacrifice their family being there, their family support being there, that has to happen more and more for it to become some kind of a groundswell. Otherwise, it'll just be like a fringe thing. People who give birth at home, people
it'll be alternative.
The way that it was here for a long, long. I mean, it still kind of is. Home birth is still not, you know, normal, like. Here, but you can say you have a home birth without somebody having a heart attack nowadays.
Yeah,
you can. Choosing to have a home birth is not such a crazy thing now. Even back when I had my first home birth 25 years ago, it was still, people are like, what? But it's shifted a little bit, but it's been 25 years.
Yeah.
For that shift. And it's not even a big shift. It's a small shift. And I probably feel that shift more because I'm involved in this work. And so home birth to me feels normal, but I know I bet if I talk to my neighbors and did a community poll, they'd be like, what? No, that's crazy. What? No, no, no. You need to go to the hospital. So it's been very, very, very slow. And that might be what it takes. People just have to plug away at it. People have to know, people in wherever they are, in Brazil, wherever, that vaginal birth is possible. It's okay. Home birth is possible and it's okay. It's just setting up the supports in your place mm-hmm. might be more difficult than for us here.
Most certainly. Yeah. And getting the, I hate to say this, but also getting the buy-in from your family mm-hmm. to support choice, right? To support that choice. Because so I have a Brazilian client right now and who is not able to have her mother and her aunties with her. And the biggest part of her postpartum period that has been so challenging for mm-hmm. her is food. Actually, she would say it is food, but it is not the actual food. Her husband made her a soup and a salad, and she started crying. She's like, "What is this?" And she's so upset. She's like, I need some rice. And where is
poor guy? The poor guy's like, what? It's Campbell's. What the hell? Yeah.
And he comes from a completely different cultural background. So they eat a lot of fish and broth and everything afterwards. And she's like, I need food. I need my bread. I need my salad. I need my food. I need, like, she's like, when you sit down, there's like five things you eat. And my mom would know, and my auntie would know, and it would be going on the oven all day. And I would just sit here and they would bring me what I need, and I don't need to ask. And it was just, big unburdening. It was not for her even about whether she had a vaginal birth or a cesarean section. What she wanted was her cultural norm. What she wanted was what she experienced with her sister. Is she came over, having never had children before, and learned how to feed her sister, and learned her mom and her aunt came over and you know, you eat certain foods and you're all together all the time. And the new parent is never alone without like a brother or a sister or an auntie or somebody. You're never alone because you might need something, you know? So yeah. It really was that. And my heart aches for those who are really doing that groundwork for home birth again now, knowing that they will have to give up such a huge part. So good on you if you are going against the grain to do what you know is best for your health, whether that is choosing a cesarean section or choosing a home birth or a vaginal birth or whatever you are choosing. You know, my heart goes out to all of you making those big choices and driving those changes and having to sacrifice that support of your family, because my heart broke for this particular client who, and I spoke to her about these things. And mm-hmm. she herself has the knowledge. She has the knowledge about vaginal birth being safer and all of these things. But even with the knowledge, the cultural aspect of it still played around the edges of her thought process, she admitted regularly. Because it's like a rite of passage almost, and you're missing a part of the rite of passage.
Yeah. Yep.
So one quote that I found, and tell me if this sounds like anything you know, said the cesarean rate could also be lowered by basic human and social skills and respectful, supporting, and empathetic relationship between care provider and birthing parent. Does that not sound like what a doula does?
Does sound familiar.
So I don't know if we have any doulas in Brazil that can pipe in, because I would super love to hear, you know, what's happening in there. I know CAPA Latin America has a huge swell of doulas down in Latin America. I do know also, I want to say, I think it was Tanis Bundy who went to, she went with CAPA Latin America down to work in a hospital for a few days to a week or whatever. And they just did birth after birth, after birth, after birth, and supporting the birthing families. And, you know, I've heard her talk about her experiences there in the not private hospitals. And it just sounded so incredibly amazing.
And the other thing that crosses my mind is the actual resources that are needed for one cesarean section are so much greater than the resources. You can have a vaginal birth anywhere. Really. You can have a vaginal birth anywhere, but there's so much more needed. So you would think in a country that's not, you know, a wealthy country, that so much resources are being funneled towards, it feels like something else is going on that we're missing. I'm being suspicious.
It's status, right? So even those who are, it is a sign of status to be able to afford to have a cesarean section.
Yes, but this is not just an issue with the elite in the country. This is like a nationwide issue. It may not be as the cesarean section rates may be lower in public hospitals, but it's still much, much higher than
other countries, and so many resources. I always liken it to, I'm thinking of it, the difference between cesarean birth and vaginal birth in terms of how much resources a cesarean needs. It's like the difference between soccer and hockey, right? soccer. You see kids in all over the world in poor countries. They don't got nothing. They don't even have a ball. All they need is some space. And I remember when I was a kid, boys would take like an empty milk carton and stuff it with newspaper, and that would be their ball. And you kick it around. This is why soccer is an international game. Whereas hockey needs extremely exclusive facilities and equipment in order to be played. And those, and also like access to like refrigeration and ice and all that. And so many more resources to play one game versus another. It's kind of like with vaginal birth and a cesarean. So what is it that's driving this need? It is status for sure. It's all of those things. There's so many pieces that are involved in this. And even poor people in poorer hospitals, poor areas and public hospitals are devoting precious healthcare dollars to promoting surgical birth. So they really, really, truly have to believe that it's safer to go to those measures. And where and how did they get those notions? What is that? Where's that coming from? And is it just their business and we should just leave people to do what they want to do?
Well, no, they're even in public hospitals, if we talk about resources, it's even public hospitals, the doctor gets to charge the public funding pool for a cesarean section, which means they still get paid more for that cesarean section than they do for attending a vaginal birth. So even in a public situation, whether they are getting paid by a family who has pooled their money so that their child, their daughter-in-law,
whatever.
That's right. We'll have a quote safe cesarean and a cesarean that creates the sense that they are of a higher status, whether they're getting it from the family or they're getting it from the public pool, that doctor still benefits by doing a cesarean section.
Mm-hmm. So, you can also assume too, though, that, you know, even in a public hospital, maybe there's a quicker, if there's a blip on the monitor or something like that, there's a quicker jumping to cesarean, like what we used to have here. Used to be, you know, if you saw any little thing, because they didn't trust vaginal birth. It wasn't necessarily that it was safer in their mind. It's that they didn't trust it. So, you know, even though we are seeing a lessening of the cesarean birth rate, there's still that fear that maybe this isn't going to go the way it's supposed to. So let's just go to a cesarean. So yeah, it's probably, I mean, obviously there's always more than one piece to any puzzle, but you know, part of that puzzle is likely just a not trusting, as we've seen here, of vaginal birth, where there's any little blip and it's like, holy crap, we gotta get this baby out. Yes. And that's gone down significantly, but I mean, it's still there I'm assuming it's going to take a little bit of time for it to leave there as well, especially since we're only considering that these efforts to make these changes, particularly in public hospitals, have only really been happening in the last 10, 20 years. Like, change takes time.
It will be interesting to see how that develops, how everything that they found out in doing that appropriate birth project. And it'll be interesting to see if the public, because even in public hospitals, what happened when that started, the first mandate in public and private hospitals were that it was illegal to do a cesarean birth before 39 weeks and elective cesarean birth before 39 weeks. That was their first step to get the NICU admissions down before doing the other thing. But across the country, you cannot book an elective cesarean before 39 weeks where there's no medical indication. And that helped initially too, because there were so many babies being born for. So again, if we go back to some of the things around body image and things like that, you know, if you do it a little earlier, you have a few less stretch marks or less stretching and things like that. So it was eking earlier and earlier and earlier. So they wanted to stop that right away. I'm really interested to see how the information they gathered from the Appropriate Birth Project will be implemented public-wide and countrywide, and if they will take the importance of education and put it in the public sector as well, and have the public sector be trusting. Because, I mean, in so many ways, they have no reason truly to trust. You know, they felt swept under the rug. They felt pushed to the side. They felt they've been given the minimum. And honestly, you go for a cesarean once you're in labor sometimes because you're denied comfort medication, you're denied epidural, you're denied medication unless you need a cesarean section, or you're ignored unless you've agreed to a C-section. So, I mean, there's much work to be done in building trust in the public sector down there, as well as creating education. But we do live, again, right now, even if someone plants the seed and hears the whisper of vaginal birth, many can find their way to some technology, to YouTube, to actually see it. Often we don't believe something unless we've seen it. We've heard it from a family member or we've seen it. And thankfully with technology, if you know somebody who knows somebody, you can get your eyes on what a home birth might look like, on what a vaginal birth might look like. And sometimes that's enough to drive change. It's not direct education, but it's indirect education.
When was the, you might have said this already, Stephanie, when was the last time in Brazil that the cesarean section rate was, you know, in accordance with World Health Organization recommendations, like 15%?
1970s.
70s. Okay.
Yeah. So from 1979, it was 15%, and 1984, it was 40%.
Mm-hmm. Wow. More than doubled.
Yeah.
What? From 79 to what?
1979 to 1984. It went from 15% to 40%.
Cesarean. That's only 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What happened? That's crazy. More than doubled in 5 years?
Yes.
Holy crap. Yeah.
And these are internet numbers, so I'm sure there's some variability, but still, the end of the 70s, it was 15%. By mid-80s, it was 40%. So it is driven by something, and it can be driven the other way. And I'm gonna keep my eyes on this. You know what else I'm keeping my eyes on? As we talk about birthing in other places, I know people know that Brazil has a high cesarean rate. I know people know that China has a high cesarean rate, but a lot of people do not know, and this is the one that's been tickling my brain, is that Ireland has a very high cesarean rate.
What?
43%.
You're lying.
And up next on our discovering.
Well, I think we're going to need to be looking into that now, aren't we?
Yes.
Well, I would also like to say that all of this talk from us Canadian people, it's very nice. Sit in our cushy houses and discuss these things about people far, far away. But I also kind of want to say, do the people of Brazil want this change? Sounds like we want it for them. We want them to have education about that vaginal birth is safe and you should want it. You should try to have it instead of doing this. And this is bad for you and this is dangerous for you. Let us not fall into that trap. You know what I'm talking about.
We do.
Yeah, let us not fall into the trap of saviorism. I think we got to be careful too. We can discuss how things are different and similar in different places without saying that people should and ought to look and do things our way, because I don't necessarily believe it's true. If we went to Brazil today and just picked a random family to stay with, and somebody in that family is having a baby, you too would get swept up into the joy and the excitement and the stresses of planning for a baby, and whether the baby is going to be born by cesarean or vaginal birth would probably take a back seat to you in some kind of way. So yeah, I just want to caution the pragmatic doulas, all of us, about that, because it is easy, because we think we know everything and we do everything right. Right. So,
well, I mean, I know I don't do everything right. And I don't personally feel that, you know.
Yeah, I don't personally feel that either. But like collectively, we kind of sometimes behave as if we do. And when we say like, I hope that they will, whatever, that will eventually lead them to doing things the way we do them, that's when we're falling into that trap. So
my dream is that they find their way to trusting that families are worth the information to make the decision, including making it important that their cultural norms be respected, alongside information that would reduce the chance of their baby going to NICU. That would, because a lot of people, even here, everywhere, often believe it won't happen to me until you're in it. And a lot of the families that are driving the change, I'm sure, have a finger in that. Or, you know, when they did decide to start looking at these numbers, it wasn't because of parents who were having the babies. It was because of the concerns around the babies. The long-term things they were looking at too were the higher babies who were born by cesarean having more respiratory distress that was ongoing, babies having high blood pressure, babies having diabetes. So it, my hope is that it goes alongside not poo-pooing their cultural norms, but having it done in such a respectful way that people feel well supported regardless of the choice they decide to move towards. You know, if I was to want anything for Brazil, it would be that.
I mean, I think in all of this, I mean, irregardless of how baby enters the world, it's about the safety of the baby and the safety of the birthing parent and long-term health issues and all of that stuff. Like it's not about, you know, making sure that baby is born vaginally. It's about making sure the baby isn't being admitted into the NICU, isn't having long-term, you know, health issues, isn't, you know, that the birthing parent isn't having hemorrhaging afterwards, that, you know, as someone who's had three babies in the NICU, cesarean birth didn't have anything to do with any of that. It was about vaginal birth. So I think this whole idea of, you know, making change and lowering cesarean rates, that goes hand in hand with making sure that we are, is that the byproduct of lowering the infant mortality rate? Like, we're trying to lower the infant mortality rate, and the byproduct of that is going to be a lower cesarean rate, potentially, if we look at it from a different angle.
But yeah, being careful in our language is certainly important, because the things that have developed all came from a sense of values outside of vaginal or cesarean. How the culture was built were around a sense of community values, and that is not to be poo-pooed, and that is not to be put aside as unimportant. Oh boy. And really, we should carry that into every aspect of things we discuss, don't you think?
You'd think.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. All right, Stephanie, who is our shout out doula of the week?
Giovanna Aiello of Mumdies. So she is a doula. She is a birth.
What's her name?
Gio.
It's Gio.
Oh, Gio. Okay.
Yeah, Gio.
I know Gio.
But in taking a, much like many of us, pivot to something that she found to be a need within the world, she developed Mumdies, underwear for after you have a baby. And yes. All the things that she had learned about support of the body after you have a baby and put them into this product. And she crowdsourced, she really put her heart and soul into this because she felt so strongly about it, and created Mumdies. And I love initiative like that. I love people who take what they've learned and fill a need. And so I want to shout out Gio Aiello from Mumdies.com, Mumdies. Go check her and her Mumdies out.
Yeah, go check her out. She's awesome. Gio came to my prenatal class as a part of her doula training, her childbirth education component. And her and I have taken
shiatsu for labor course together. That was great. It was only the two of us. So she's familiar with my tailbone as I am with hers.
Well, that's good.
She's really awesome. So yes, do check out Mumdi's. It seems like an amazing product, and she has worked super hard to get it out there. Mumdi's.
We should have her on. Somebody do that.
We should. I'll talk
to her. Yeah. Yeah.
That'd be cool. Promote the crap out of that, because they look cool. I just went on the website.
She is cool. Yeah. And that, it really seems like it would be a helpful product.
I think so. So next week we are talking about prenatals.
Yes.
Prenatals.
Are they even important anymore? Sorry, just gonna stir the pot with that one. Now, of course,
oh my God. Are they even important anymore? Do you even want to do them anymore?
I'll just call me when you're in labor. I'll just show up.
Yeah.
Yep. Even that I'm not doing anymore. I'm showing
even, yeah, either. even that. There's a question. Yeah. Prenatals. All right. So that's what we'll talk about next week. And everybody needs to stay safe. And if you are having Thanksgiving dinner this weekend, please take a moment to remember the origins of this holiday and where it all started.
If you did have it 2 weeks ago, we hope that you did that.
Did you have Thanksgiving dinner 2 weeks ago?
This is going to air in like the end of October.
Oh, that's right.
This is going to air.
Like... Yeah, you've already had it. You've already had it. So I hope that you did that.
Awesome.
And if not, just pull up a chair at dinner time and have that conversation now, damn it. You can do it anytime. It's never a bad time to have a discussion about our responsibilities.
I need to learn the art of speaking forward, like remembering when the episode is going to be aired and speaking as if we're in that time. So when is this like going to be aired?
Everyone has a happy Halloween because we're almost there.
Well, yeah. When, what date will
it's going to be aired on the 18th of October.
Okay. On the 18th of October, when you hear this, in 2 days, I'll be going to Nova Scotia. I am going to Nova Scotia.
Cool.
So,
that's very exciting. So if this is airing on the 18th, I hope you've picked up all of your Halloween candy, because otherwise you're going to get the crappy stuff that's at the bottom of the barrel.
So, and the trick-or-treaters will hate you.
My kid said to me, Mom, you're kind of falling behind. We don't have Halloween candy yet. It's the first goddamn week of October, and I don't want to eat it all before goddamn Halloween. So no, I have not purchased it. Y'all can wait a bit.
Absolutely.
Calm the fuck down. I actually have my Halloween costume. Just need to buy one more thing. I'm going as Linda Belcher from Bob's Burgers.
Oh my God, Linda!
Bob!
I gotta watch
my red shirt.
This is the third time I've heard about it this week. So that's a sign. I gotta watch it.
You gotta go do it.
Fucking hilarious. I don't like adult cartoons. Like, I don't like The Simpsons or American Dad or any of those other ones. But God, this is so funny.
All of the ones that you just mentioned are also friggin' hilarious. I think The Simpsons is so full of wit and such good writing, and same with like Family Guy. They're raunchy and out of order lots of times, but they're hilarious. So I can imagine that Bob's Burgers is probably friggin' hilarious too.
There's less raunch. Like, there's none of that raunch, which I don't really like.
That's in Family Guy, but there isn't raunch in really The Simpsons.
No,
The Simpsons is just like straight up nonsense.
Yeah,
funny nonsense.
I like it. So yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Give it a watch. Okay.
Everybody, go watch Bob's Burgers. And then, but before you do that, you really should pull up your, wherever you're listening to this, and you should rate us a 5-star. You really should. Just go do that now.
Unless you feel it's 4, in which case we don't want to tell you what to do because we're doulas and we don't do that.
Oh, can somebody pull up a nice email we got? I think somebody gave us a nice email.
They did?
But I'm on my phone, so I can't do it, or I'll lose my thing, my connection maybe. Yeah, check our email. I'm pretty sure somebody gave us a nice email. Came yesterday.
Oh, just came to us through Cheyenne?
Pardon?
Was this the person who came to us through Cheyenne?
I don't know, because I only saw like the notification, so I didn't open it up and see the whole thing.
Well, no, there was somebody sent one through Cheyenne that wanted us to have their person on as a pod, as a guest.
Oh, they weren't giving us lots of props and compliments. Damn.
No.
It. Okay.
No.
Well, can people out there, obviously we need one. We need some of that. So can you just send it to us by giving us 4 or 5 star reviews as you are so inclined? Please.
I will support you through that.
All right. Yeah. Have okay. a good one, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.